Welcome to the Chase MedSearch Podcast, the place where we dive deep into the medical device sales industry by discussing the current trends, timeless philosophies, and amazing experiences that shape our niche of the industry. Join me, Jordan Chase, on a guided tour as I speak with established sales leaders and professionals as they share stories that will help you get in, stay in, and thrive in your medical device sales career. Let's start the show. All right. Welcome back to the Chase MedSearch Podcast. It's hard to describe how excited I am to have my guest, Dr. Jeffrey Moore, on today. Jeffrey is an author, speaker, and advisor who splits his consulting time between startup companies in wildcat venture partners, portfolios, and established high-tech enterprises like Salesforce, Microsoft, Autodesk, Gainsight, Google, and Splunk. He is the author of 8 books, including The Guerrilla Game, Inside the Tornado, Zone to Win, and the book that we'll be discussing highlights from today, Crossing the Chasm, which is in its 3rd edition and has sold more than 1 million copies. Dr. Moore has a bachelor's in American literature from Stanford University and a PhD in English literature from the University of Washington. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Moore.
Well, you probably should drop the doctor because it is in medieval English literature and I'm supposed to be in tech. So I think Jeff will be good.
I love it. Jeff will be good. Okay, we can do that. It's a delight to have you on. As I mentioned in kind of the warm-up, I have several customer sets that just really appreciate your work and implement it in daily basis and have tried to drive it throughout their entire organization and are reaping some very positive benefits. But just to start, 3 editions, over 1 million copies sold, published in 1991, and it's one of Inc. magazine's top 10 marketing books of all time. The praise for Crossing the Chasm is not hard to find. Why do you think it endures so well and speaks to generation after generation of marketeers and salespeople in high-tech industries?
That's a great question. First of all, the book really, the sweet spot for the Crossing the Chasm strategy is anything that has a disruptive innovation that's going to be sold to other enterprises. So it's more of a B2B as opposed to a B2C type of framework. Mm-hmm. But in that framework, the adoption of disruptive technology, it follows a pattern that has just held true. And as you double click into it and you understand, well, why is that happening? It's because the personas that get involved in adopting things, they're persistent. Mm. And so you have the early adopters who've had this persona of, hey, it's exciting. Let's try something new. This is really cool. You know, we want to get ahead of things. And they create something we call the early market. And then there's this chasm because the bulk of the money in the world is run by people who are going, well, I don't know. Maybe. I'm not an expert in this. So what they do is they start talking to each other saying, well, I don't know. Are you doing this yet? Are you doing it yet? And typically the answer at the beginning is, well, not yet. Well, me neither. Okay, we'll just wait. So, and that creates mm-hmm. the chasm, right?
Right.
The other thing that happens later on, if it's successful, is all of a sudden you ask your friends, you say, well, you're not doing that yet, are you? Oh, yeah, we are. You are? Yeah. Oh, so are we. Oh, really? Oh, I better too. Mm-hmm. And so it creates that thing we call the tornado, which was, so the chasm is this pragmatic group of people going, I think it's too soon. And the tornado is, oh my gosh, I think it might be too late.
Right.
And so it creates this really, really almost violent shift in a market from low growth to high growth. And that's been, that's what's been behind all the high-tech enthusiasm, the high-tech stock market. The NASDAQ, arguably, it made its claim to fame based on this model. So I think that's why it's held up.
That's fantastic. It has held up very well and holds up. And I'm the proud owner of a Crossing the Chasm paperback, and I have the audiobook on Audible. And as I listened to it and read it, it put language and terminology around things that I've seen for decades helping recruit talent for early stage startup medical device companies. And as I mentioned to you, you know, people are grabbing these concepts, staying true to them, sort of integrating them in their sales teams and staying consistent with them. Did you realize you were so popular in the early stage medical device niche of the industry?
Probably not. Although I think anytime, if you think about early stage medical devices, they have to go through this challenge of chasms and hopefully with a tornado in their future. Mm-hmm. I have a lot of empathy for the salespeople because One of the things you realize is the sales playbook that works in the early market with the people that who believe what you believe and are kind of wanting to lean in, you know, the key opinion leaders or whoever you would want to call it in the medical community, that playbook doesn't work for crossing the chasm.
Right.
So in other words, so your early success is based on an early market playbook, but then you have to change the playbook. And the people that are good at the chasm crossing playbook, which is focus on a particular use case in a very specific segment, and don't worry about volume, don't worry about sales coverage, worry about solving a really tough problem end to end and getting a reputation as the go-to solution for that particular problem, typically in a very narrow segment of the market. It's just a and be much more consultative, much more you're not creating a vision. You're really focusing on the problem. You're talking the customer's problem language. You get very deep into their domain, whatever they're struggling with. But it's a different personality. It's a different skill set. And then just to complete the irony is when you're successful with that one and you have crossed the chasm and you have got that first use case completely solidified and you're now credible, then now you do need to expand sales. And now you do need to become much more competitive with other companies and expand geographically and expand, you know, use cases and whatever. So there's these three playbooks, and the people that are good at one playbook are typically not very good at the other two. So whether you're managing a sales team, recruiting a sales team, or participating in a sales team, I think it's really important to kind of understand, well, which of these am I best at? Everybody can do it to some degree, but which am I best at?
Right.
And is it my time or not? And kind of proceed accordingly.
That's an excellent insight. And you see that as companies grow and change and evolve, you know, sometimes the first leadership team and the first even handful of salespeople that were there are not there when it's time to cross the chasm or right after the chasm has been crossed or is starting to be, they depart.
Yeah.
You know, they may exercise options or things like that.
Yeah.
What I really loved about your book was the technology adoption lifecycle. I felt like that was key to some of the things that I've seen. Could you just, you touched on it. Could you script that out for us just a little bit?
Sure. So it turns out this was some work done by a guy named Everett Rogers back in the 50s, I think originally, maybe 60s, at Harvard Business School. But basically what he said is, when you introduce a disruptive innovation into any community in the United States and Japan and South Africa, it doesn't matter where you are, the community will sort of self-organize into these five different adoption strategies. They kind of go from beginning to early to late. So the first one he called the innovators, we call them the technology enthusiasts. But the technology enthusiasts are people who go, I just, this chat GPT generative AI, I want to know how it works. I read books about it. I'm going to try to code with it. You know, they get right into the middle of it and they don't have any money typically, but they're very enthusiastic and they, you know, write blogs about it and they have t-shirts and they stay up all night playing with it, that kind of stuff. So they often staff some of these startups. But the second persona is the one that makes a big difference in the early market. Everett called them the early adopter. We call them the visionary. But the visionary is the exceptional individual who goes, I know this is early. I know this hasn't been proven yet, but I believe that this is a game changer. And I am willing to put my personal credibility and my personal capital behind endorsing this. And I'm going to actually try to be the first mover. And I'm going to hopefully change the future of my company and maybe even my industry by adopting this stuff. So that would be like a Jeff Bezos with Amazon Books, right? And maybe before that, there was a guy named Mark Andreessen who was more of the technology enthusiast about, you know, this is a web browser and here's how it would work and Netscape Navigator kind of stuff. Well, then, okay, those are those first two personas. Then the chasm happens because the third persona, Everett Rogers called them the early majority. We call them the pragmatists. But pragmatists are saying, look, if this is going to help, we're going to use it. But until it's ready for prime time, it's going to suck up more resources than we're going to get back. And we have other things to do. So we're not going to adopt it yet, but we're going to keep an eye on it. And when this thing is ready, when I see enough people like me doing it, I'm going to do it. Well, we call that the junior high dance problem, right? Like, how do I get the dance started? And so it turned out the crossing the chasm strategy was find a small subset of the pragmatist community that are in desperate situations. They have a use case. They can't solve their use case with any conventional methods. The use case is getting worse. It's causing problems, not just for their department. It's causing problems for the entire enterprise, may even be causing problems for the entire industry. Mm. And then usually it's not a big market. And usually the solution to that problem is very gnarly and requires a lot of extra work. So the existing incumbents are going, no, too small a market, too much work. We're not going to do this. But a startup or anybody crossing the chasm goes, okay, but it's big enough for me. And that was how we got those, we called them pragmatists in pain. Mm-hmm. And then once you got one pragmatist in pain, now you have the beginning of a word of mouth network. Now, if you go to an adjacent market segment, maybe somebody who has a similar use case or is in the same industry, then they go, oh, well, you're having success with it. Maybe I could have success with it. But again, it's still very cautious, you know, and it's still problem driven. I will do it if I have a problem that it solves. But if I don't have a problem, I'm not going to just adopt it. And then what happens after a while, and this is still the pragmatist, this is still the third of the five communities, pragmatist community. Then what happens is when enough people adopt it, people look around and go, holy smoke, this is new. This is the new reality. This, your mobile phones, everybody has a mobile phone. You have to have a mobile app. You have to have Wi-Fi. You should be in cloud computing. Mm-hmm. And then what happens is everybody gets a budget for it. And that starts out the biggest land rush, because when people have a budget, they're going to spend it.
Right.
And they're either going to spend it with you or your competitor. So there's this incredible thing we call the tornado, where just there's this huge sucking vortex of demand that anybody in the category gets sucked into that thing. And it's a fight for market share. And the person who comes out the market share winner is the one that pragmatic people say, well, yeah, I mean, mobile phones, I think it's Apple, right? Sure, is it Microsoft? Thought it might have been Nokia, but sure it wasn't Nokia. You know, so who's the winner?
Mm-hmm.
And then once that's kind of done, then the last two constituencies are, Rogers called them the late adopters and the laggards. We call them the conservatives and the skeptics. But the point is, they kind of go along for the ride because it's like, well, the world has changed and this is not something I was looking forward to, but we're going to do whatever the pragmatists do. So it turns out the entire fight for the pragmatist, winning that first set of pragmatists, is the key to the dynamic of the whole thing.
That's a great overview. And that first set represents about a third of the market.
It's different in different markets. I think the mathematics of it mm-hmm. is different for each market.
Okay.
The way in which Rogers did it, he was using actually statistics. So he was talking about 2 sigma and 3 sigma.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be like, it turns out 3 sigma is about 3% and 2 sigma is about 13%. So you could say if it literally was following the math of his distribution curve, you'd say 16%. I don't think that's been a reliable number for me.
Okay.
So I think it changes with each market.
That's great. You know, one of the things I was thinking about as I read your book, with technologists, I think a lot of medical device people would say they can kind of find those folks. They know who those doctors are. They love technology for technology's sake. They can get on board with anything new. They want to know it. They want to understand it, as you said. Visionaries are a little different, but I was thinking about how to find them. And then I read a sentence in your book that said, they'll find you. Talk to us about that.
The visionary might be like at a major healthcare organization. It might be a Mayo Clinic or a Kaiser or a, you know, mm-hmm. or whatever. But it's not the company. It's an individual. But it's a senior executive who has enough power within their management structure to take a budget risk, kind of on their own initiative, a material budget risk on their own initiative.
Mm-hmm.
So the way they find you is, first of all, they hear about you from the key opinion leaders, from the enthusiasts. Because they keep in touch. The visionaries keep in touch with the technology enthusiasts because they want to know what's the latest, greatest thing. Because their thought is not, I want to adopt it because it's cool technology. Their thought is, I want to adopt it because it could change the world. I want to change the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they do is they go to conferences and they will hear you speak at a conference. And in fact, they may even attend a conference to hear you speak. Or they may search, now that we're all digital and, you know, we're all doing all this stuff on the web, it's much easier to get your content, your ideas in front of these people. And they'll take your Zoom call.
Mm-hmm.
But they're proactively leaning in, as opposed to the average executive who has an administrative assistant whose number one job is to keep you out.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And when you gather those folks in, the technologists, the visionaries, et cetera, you get a burst of, you know, excitement and energy. You get some early money. And you say that that's kind of one of the most dangerous times for a startup.
Well, here's the thing. yes, you get some early money. It's just some excitement. You want one more thing from the early market for sure. Mm-hmm. And that's what we call a marquee reference account. Mm-hmm. The marquee reference account is some brand name institution that everybody's heard of. Nobody's ever heard of your company, but they've heard of this company.
Right.
And this company has taken your technology and done something amazing with it and wants to talk about it. So what that does, and I'll give you two examples. When Amazon said they were going to do cloud computing, people thought, this is just nuts. No real enterprise is going to put their computer systems in the cloud, for God's sake. And then all of a sudden, they announced the CIA. Mm. You thought, well, what the CIA was doing. Well, okay. Yeah. And a version of it with Salesforce. You know, Salesforce was you know, very popular with sales teams here and there. It was kind of growing sort of from the bottom up, kind of on a grassroots thing. But they thought, well, you know, but nobody, you know, look, no major corporation is going to put all of their customer information in a database in the cloud. And then Merrill Lynch did. Mm-hmm. And you went, whoa.
Right.
So it's important in the early market that you get at least one, and often you can get two or three companies who are brand name companies who go way ahead of the herd. Mm-hmm. The key thing to remember about, though, it's a project model. It's not scalable. And you want to think it was your product that won the day. It wasn't. Mm-hmm. It was your vision, your product, and then putting your engineering team behind doing a whole lot of extra work only for that one customer that nobody else would ever have asked for, but make it happen.
Right.
So the danger you have at that point is you've said, oh, wow, we've got these sales, that we're getting these great articles, people want us to speak at conferences, let's build our sales force. But just then is when you're like, nope, we got to switch plays. We got to go to the chasm crossing play. And the chasm crossing play is nothing like a visionary play. Mm-hmm. It's a much more pedestrian, hey, I'm just going to focus on this one problem, this one condition. Like in medical things, it would be like, you know, there's some orphan condition that it's like orphan drugs, right? Mm-hmm. You've got something where, God, there's only like 50 or 100 people in the whole world that have this problem, but it's unsolvable by anything else. Mm-hmm. And so what you become is a standard of care for that problem.
Right. Yeah. I'm thinking of a client I won't name right now that identified a niche of 30 million patients. Okay. Which doesn't sound small, but I mean, you know.
But in their world, it probably didn't sound big to them, right?
Exactly. But yeah. That would fit with your, and they go after that particular patient population, the doctors who treat them really hard. So in your example, a figurehead or flagship type of company would be like Mayo Clinic or Stanford, Mount Sinai, something, a name brand.
Exactly.
That people know and respect.
Okay. Exactly. Got it. And then the condition would be, so for example, you know, I've spent some time with the guys at Guardant Health. They do diagnostics for cancer. But so they'll pick one form of cancer. I can't remember if it was colorectal or whatever it was. But whatever it was, you know, they were using a blood test. Mm-hmm. They were testing you with a blood test, not a stool sample. So it was an interesting problem for, because there's a class of colorectal patients that really won't give you a stool sample for
right.
Perhaps somewhat obvious reasons.
Yeah.
But anyway, but the point is, it's not a big market. Mm-hmm. But when you solve for that market, you get credibility for a bunch of other markets.
Got it. And then you get your references.
And once you, yeah. And mm-hmm. of course, you know, think about the medical community. It's a very reference oriented community. I mean, they
extremely
talk to each other and they try to follow each other's footsteps.
Absolutely. If we were to take a thought exercise and just picture it, you know, the entire sales team from the chief commercial officer to the VP of sales down to the last lowly person in the field, completely bought into crossing the chasm. How in have you seen it play out where the sales team is dedicated to this notion? What does it look like when they're playing their part really effectively?
First of all, it's typically not your whole sales team. There always mm-hmm. is some amount of horizontal coverage because you get incoming unsolicited opportunities, right?
Sure.
And you don't want to turn them down. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting because initially, the first few times we implemented this, I can remember the horizontal team thought, well, God, don't get caught in that stupid little vertical team because those guys are just, their market's like tiny and their territory, I mean, they've got like five customers or mm-hmm. terrible. But then what would happen is they were the guys making quota. In fact, right. They were blowing out their quotas. They're like, well, how do I get on the vertical team? because the thing right. that the even though the market was small and the territory and the number of prospects were limited, the urgency to buy was high. Hmm. And so the ability to convert a lead into a sale was much higher, much, much higher. And so that was the game plan. So the way you organize it is you say, look, at the time of catching what we call our first beachhead market, you would like, first of all, you'd like to keep your entire sales team small because you're not ready for going for big coverage.
Right.
But you would say, I put two thirds of my team into this tiny vertical segment and one third or even a quarter for just kind of catching everything else. And when I get my second segment or my third segment, I'm going to start taking that first segment and turning it over if I can to partners and allies. But if not, I'll expand some more vertically, and maybe I still keep two thirds of my team in verticals. But by the time we're the second or third vertical, and if the category is catching on, and that's about the time it would be catching on, then you go, okay, I want to start going horizontal. And that's when you hire the VP of sales, and that's when you have all your district territories, and now you're looking for the traditional salesperson. Prior to the tornado, you have to remember, there's no budget.
Right.
In the early market, the customer has to create the budget.
Mm-hmm.
In the crossing the chasm, they have to redirect the budget.
Hmm.
In other words, they have money, but they're not spending it on your category.
Right.
They're spending it on the old stuff. So the money is there, but you got to redirect. So think about the sales. Think about how much sales time it takes to either help a customer create budget or help a customer redirect budget, as opposed to in the tornado, where the guy says, I got budget, I'm spending it this year, I just don't know if I'm going to spend it on you.
Hmm.
But that's a classic sales problem. You say, oh, well, let me give you 10 reasons why you should spend it on me.
Right, absolutely. You know, so when we get to the point where we're hiring salespeople, right, and it's justified, if you could wave a wand and drill a few things into their head that are essential as you're about to unleash this sales team on customers or potential customers, what would you say to them? Hey, these are three things that you've got to keep in mind as you get out.
Yeah. And again, let's distinguish between when we're crossing the chasm and the tornado.
Absolutely.
When you're crossing the chasm, you don't even have to worry about the tornado. The tornado is a salesperson's dream.
Mm-hmm.
So you just hire Velociraptor meat-eating salespeople and let them go. but the chasm is a little bit weird.
Right.
So the three things you tell a sales team going into a chasm. Number one, no demo on the first call because it's not about us. You don't matter and we don't matter. What matters is this customer is in trouble and they want, and they need therapy. and so the first thing is the first conversations around, hey, we've been talking with a bunch of people in your industry and boy, it sure seems like patients with this condition, there's just really no good answer for them.
Hmm.
At least that's what they're telling us. Do you find that true?
Hmm.
And what you're doing is you're doing a problem-based sort of discovery with them. And what'll happen is these people will spill their guts. They haven't had anybody ask them that question forever. It's just like, oh my God. And they'll talk about all the problems they're having. And you're going, oh yeah, and I heard and you keep on using more stories from other companies.
Hmm.
Oh yeah, well, you know, there's the other company down the street. Yeah, I had that. Yeah. And actually they had this problem. Do you have that problem too? Blah, 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 blah. So, and what you're doing is you spend 80% of the time talking about the problem and how tough the problem is and how many challenges are with the problem. And then, because now you've become a trusted advisor, once you've had that conversation, they see you totally differently. And then you say, you know, by the way, we think we've cracked this nut. We really do. We really think we've nailed it. But, you know, but we should prove it. I mean, we have to prove it to you. Because remember, this person's a pragmatist. They're not a visionary.
Right.
They need to have it proven to them. But here's what we're doing. Here's how it works. Here's how we could, you know, prove it out with your team. So it's don't talk about yourself. Don't give a demo on the first call. Build the relationship first, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
And then second, don't talk about your product. Talk about the problem and then the solution.
Mm-hmm.
And so you bring your product in late into the game. And then the third thing is, you need the commitment of your entire company. And we will not leave until your problem is off the table. I don't care what it's going to take. My company is totally committed to taking this problem off the table because it's the only problem we're focused on right now. I mean, it's our number one priority as a company. And so if you come up with a requirement that's not in our product, we'll either find a product that it is in or we'll change our product. We'll do whatever it takes. And so you don't discount. You don't try to give it away. You can actually charge a very good premium price for it. But what you can't do is get them almost to the goal line, but not over the goal line.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do a field goal in the red zone. You got to get a touchdown.
Right. You point out, though, that not every sale is a good sale at this point.
The key thing there is we're trying to establish credibility as a company and as a solution provider. So the way you do that is you get more than one customer who endorses the same solution for the same problem. And the reason that works is people who share a problem talk to each other. So in other words, chiropractors who are, you know, working on broken necks talk to each other, and they don't talk to cardiologists. And they also don't talk to dentists, and they don't talk to football teams. So if you get a Dallas Cowboy deal, that doesn't help you with a chiropractor.
Right.
Even if a dentist deal doesn't help you. But two or three or four chiropractors, and now it's like, well, what do they know that I don't know? And these are my peeps, right? So what I want to do what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens is if you make the mistake, in fact, I was in a company that went south because it made this mistake, of taking a big deal that's completely off of your roadmap and it's not your crossing the chasm target. What happens is you get a nice big sale. Somebody got a nice commission check, but the company has to redirect a whole bunch of engineering now in another direction, and you don't have enough resources to do it.
Hmm.
Because remember, until you become established as a go-to solution, everything's a snowflake. So every customer's a project. And at some point, it doesn't scale. You can't scale.
Right. Hmm. Interesting. You've worked with, I'm sure, innumerable marketers and salespeople at this point. Is there someone in particular when you think about, people who do this really well from the commercial aspect? Anybody come to mind? And kind of what traits do you see in them?
Well, names aren't coming to mind, but the traits are.
Mm-hmm.
So the first trait is it's a kind of that design thinking idea.
Yeah.
They think backward from the customer's problem, mm-hmm. not forward from their product's roadmap. Okay. They're always working backwards. Mm-hmm. They're also intellectually curious, meaning they actually like to interrogate customers about what is really happening, as opposed to another kind of salesperson who likes to just paper over all doubts and say, look at, my solution solves everything. Don't worry about it.
Hmm.
That would be a bad characteristic. The marketeers also are good at being authentic as opposed to flashy. So flashy works well later in the game, but not when you're crossing mm-hmm. the chasm. Crossing the chasm is a time where there's a fair amount of anxiety. Part of the energy and the urgency is based on anxiety, the customer's anxiety,
mm-hmm.
and so you need to have messaging that honors their anxiety. So in fact, this is something that Salesforce actually struggles with. I tease Salesforce all the time. I say sales, because I love Salesforce. I've been working with them the last 10 years.
Hmm.
But their marketing is so optimistic. I say, God, it's like going to Disneyland. I mean, you have cartoon characters everywhere in your marketing, right? And everybody is always happy, and the customer always is delighted. And I said, we need less Disney and more Dante. We need the Inferno. We need to, people are going through hell here, people. and so I think when you're crossing the chasm, it's a little bit more Dante. Mm-hmm. And then later on, you can get to the Disney, but not when you're crossing the chasm.
It's fantastic. Well, back to this early majority. And when we look at it, this is, I think you likened it to a crab scurrying for safety. This is where people fall into the chasm. There's some pretty terrible scenario scripted out in your book where this happens. Just maybe take us through one of them where, people see the flash in the pan, they see it, they think it's about to happen, and they just go whole hog.
And they do, but this is particularly true. I mean, it has been true in the venture community, but you have these, pets.com. Remember, there was a sock puppet in the middle of the Super Bowl. The internet was going to change everything,
mm-hmm.
and then the tech bubble goes bam, right? So what happens is they mistake the enthusiasm of the early market. And with a consumer product, by the way, you can get quite a lot of enthusiasm. You can get, the consumer markets are very large. So 16% of a large market is a large market, but it's still running on the idea of I want the latest, greatest, coolest thing. And the problem with that market from a consumer point of view is 2 years from now, that won't be the cool thing. And so if you didn't cross the chasm, then now you're kind of like sophomore slump. You're not, there's a new freshman class. The cool kids are over. Johnny come lately, the new kid in town kind of thing. But in a B2B world, the problem is the pragmatists are saying, yes, it sounds good. yes, I think we'll do it, but not now. And the problem is you're spending a boatload of money as a company. And if you're doing a lot of marketing, you're spending two boatloads of money, one on engineering and one on marketing. Mm-hmm. And it's just, you can't sustain it. And you know, eventually somebody will do it. Oracle in the 1990s had essentially Netflix's business model in Florida. Mm-hmm. Well, we'll do cable to the home. It was just too expensive, and it was too early, way too early. So what happens is the world doesn't reject you. They actually, in fact, the worst thing is they say, this is terrific. You should come back and give another demo. So you have sales cycles that go on forever. Mm. because by the way, the pragmatist wants to get educated. They want to look like they're forward thinking, but they're not going to buy anything. They maybe they do a pilot in Poughkeepsie. You know, I mean, that's it. That's it. You know, so very tough.
Mm-hmm. And you also kind of talked about, you know, companies that continue to feed off of sort of this early market, and they circle around and they circle around, and they just never, they've got enough to survive, but they don't have enough to ever cross over the chasm into the early majority.
Yeah, that's really it. When you're in a startup, you'll have a few customers. Look, when you get the early market, by the way, these are marquee customers. So by the way, they don't want you to go out of existence. Mm-hmm. So they'll keep you alive, but they can't grow you. So you're stuck at, you know, sales are flat. Mm-hmm. You know, the salespeople leave because there's no way you're not going to go to club,
right?
You know, that's not what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. So then you have increasingly you become kind of like a support and maintenance oriented thing, and eventually your best fate is to get bought by somebody who can fold you someplace.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you're just not going anywhere.
That's absolutely right. I don't want to go through the whole book on the podcast. I want to recommend that the listeners buy the book. Okay, because I know I'm lifting a lot of material out of here for our talk, and I appreciate
great.
It.
It's great. It's fun.
Well, it's great having you on. We probably need to land the plane on this interview. I know we could talk for a lot longer, but I really appreciate you being on, Jeff. This is phenomenal. This gives my listeners in the audience just a little taste of the things that are going on in medical, and these are the folks who understand these concepts and interact with them. These are folks that are getting hired into premium jobs in medical.
Yeah.
Real premium.
And two things that I care about. So first of all, because I'm part of the aging demographic, I'm probably going to be using some of these devices myself. So God bless them. But second of all, I have a lot of empathy for people bringing disruptive technology into a regulated industry. Hmm. Because it's not a marriage made in heaven, right? Regulatory regimes are designed to retard the rapid deployment of innovation, and you're trying to accelerate it. There's no fix for it. I mean, in other words, yes, they are, and yes, you are. So you basically just have to kind of wrestle it to the ground. But that takes skill, and it takes commitment. And so the people that are, you know, people who are doing this work, that are listening to this podcast, God bless you, because we need it, and it's not easy work.
It's not easy work. I mean, when you're trying to change a physician's mind is one thing. And then if it's disruptive, it's not going to change only the way they work. That's the way their staff works. The surgery center or the OR may work, or the entire health system may work.
Well, and then you have to get the payers on board. Mm-hmm. I will say one thing that I think one of the things we have seen with social media is there is a possibility of organizing the patient cohort to put back pressure on the regulatory regimes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that is, it doesn't work in every situation, but it is a lever that we didn't have 20 years ago.
Right. That's very, very true. And you see it. You see it through word of mouth and Facebook and quirky little ads that some of my clients run from time to time, engaging interest and all that. So, well, this has been interesting. Thank you for being on, Jeff. This was great.
Well, Jordan, it's a pleasure. I really, you know, it's an industry I care about, and thank you for having me.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for joining us on the Chase MedSearch podcast. I hope that you gained some helpful insight from today's episode. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe so you don't miss future episodes, and give us a like on your favorite streaming platform. It really helps grow our audience. For more information on Chase MedSearch, visit our website at chasemedsearch.com. Thanks again for joining us. Until next time, I'm Jordan Chase, and this has been the Chase MedSearch Podcast.